hopefully unstoppable, and that's the reason that Joe Biden's ordered his leading opponent arrested on 91 fake and phony charges. 91. How many charges are there? But we're going to ask for dismissals of a lot of it. Most of it is just, you ask for dismissal. It's called dismiss the charges. But remember, it's a Democrat charging his opponent. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. That means that if I win and somebody wants to run against me, I call my attorney general. I say, listen, indict him.
Former President Donald Trump has been indicted in four separate criminal cases, which together include allegations that he violated Georgia's Racketeering, Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, conspired to defraud the U.S., mishandled classified documents and falsified business records. He has pleaded not guilty or otherwise denied the charges in all cases. Trump is still aiming to be a presidential candidate in 2024, raising the question of whether he is attempting to evade the rule of law by running for office while under investigation and facing criminal charges. This podcast discusses these issues and assesses the impact of Trump's legal troubles on his support base, ultimately asking what this means for American democracy. Speaking to journalist Bill Roberts first is John T. Shaw. Shaw is the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute and formerly a reporter in Washington for more than two decades.
What do you think about this moment that we're in?
It's really extraordinary that we have a former president of the United States under criminal indictment with many, many serious charges pending. He's an active candidate for president and is actually the leading and prohibitive favorite of the Republican Party. Just as these cases are moving forward in the judicial system. And we've never had a former president under criminal indictment before. Almost the deeper that former President Trump's legal travails get, the more politically solid he is with his base of about 30, 32, 35% of the Republican voters. And in our primary system, where it's winner-take-all, particularly in the early races, Trump getting 32-33% of the vote will win primaries and seems very likely to be on his way to a nomination. And then we face the incredible situation of the nominee of one of the two major parties, a former president, who is possibly in court in the fall of 2024.
Bill Roberts talks to Paul Pelletier, an attorney and consultant who worked in the Department of Justice as white-collar trial attorney on fraud cases for more than 25 years.
There is another federal case pending against a former president, this one involving the January 6 riot in Washington, D.C., brought by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith. It's narrowly tailored in the sense that Trump is the one who's charged. There are some unindicted co-conspirators around it. And that really kind of differentiates it from the similar case in Fulton County, Georgia, where you have 19 defendants charged in a RICO case. The U.S. indictment in Washington is basically alleges that it's an attempt to defraud the United States government. What do we make of this? Who is Jack Smith and where do we see that headed?
Jack Smith was an Eastern District of New York criminal prosecutor for many years. He then, where I got to know him, he moved to the main justice of the Department of Justice. He was chief of the public integrity unit there while I was chief of the fraud section. So he had that job for a while. He then became the first assistant U.S. attorney in Memphis, Tennessee. And then he went over to The Hague to be a prosecutor over The Hague war crimes. But a long career at the Department of Justice at very high levels in both U.S. Attorney's Office and in the criminal division at the Department of Justice and at U.S. Attorney's, various U.S. Attorney's Offices. So he has a wide array of experience. He has shown in the past that he's not afraid to prosecute the tough cases. And he's also responsible for leading the charge as it relates to the January 6th indictment. Now, the January 6th indictment is unique, as you said, but not necessarily because it's narrowly focused. It's narrowly tailored to one defendant, but it talks about all of the aspects of the scheme to undermine the peaceful transfer of power after the 2020 election. I think it was really real smart of Jack Smith and his team to only name one defendant, because I think it's very clear that Jack Smith wants to have a trial before the election. Having charged it in D.C., he'll get a D.C. jury, he'll get a D.C. judge, and he has gotten a D.C. judge, Judge Chutkan, who's a very tough judge. Now, if it was a multiple defendant case, you wouldn't be able to do that necessarily because of other lawyers' trial schedules, other lawyers' motions practice. This is a case that appears to be narrowly tailored. It looks like they've kept most of the national security information out of the evidentiary pool. So it looks like they're not going to have any national security issues. And they're going to be able to narrow the focus of the evidence to the facts outlined in the indictment, which occurred essentially between November 3rd and January 20th, 2021. So I think Jack Smith has done a brilliant job in making the indictment bulletproof, at least as it relates to making sure the evidence gets in, number one, and number two, making sure that he gets to trial in an expeditious manner. And as it relates to the January 6th case that's before Judge Chutkan, I think that we have a lot of this talk about First Amendment and how all of these individual acts, when looked at individually, were acts of legitimate expression of First Amendment rights. And I think that certainly that each act taken individually can be considered that way. When you compare it to how a crime occurs, it's completely different. Like, there's nothing wrong with asking someone to give you a ride to the bank. There's nothing wrong with sitting at your home and writing a letter saying, I think that a bank should give me all the money in the teller window. And there's nothing, you can do that all day long. But when you put those things together and you ask someone to take you to the bank and you hand that note to a bank teller for the purpose of giving you the money, that's called bank robbery. So I think people should understand that just because individual actions themselves might be perfectly protected by the First Amendment and legitimate, it's when you place them all in context of what the entire enterprise is about that we see becomes a crime. So I think that the confusion that's been created or tried to be created around that is pretty simple to explain away.
John T. Shaw.
Well, I mean, I think it really goes to the essence of our democracy and the heart of a democracy, which is the peaceful transfer of power. And I think that the historical significance of this is literally impossible to overstate. If that norm, if that tradition is tossed out the window or forgiven or viewed as permissible, it is just really hard to imagine how, you know, our democracy goes forward in a vibrant and credible way. And it bleeds down into all other units of government. I mean, if it literally gets to the point that the only time an election counts is when you win, then we're not going to be able to keep this country together. It's just that simple.
Gene Rossi is a shareholder at Carlton Fields in Washington, D.C. He was a former federal prosecutor and represented defendants, targets, and witnesses in high-profile criminal and civil matters. Here, he discusses the racketeer-influenced corrupt organizations, or RICO Act, case against Trump and its significance in the January 6th Capitol case.
Trump has pleaded not guilty, and he's fundraising off of this. Tell us about this. I mean, this is a massive case, is it not?
They have charged Donald Trump and 18 other people with an extremely serious charge called RICO. And what that basically is this. If you have an association in fact, or some type of enterprise, a business, or any group that gets together and commits various crimes, you can charge them as an enterprise with a criminal purpose. So the enterprise and a criminal entity in that RICO charge in Fulton County is Donald Trump's efforts to spread a lie that the election was stolen, use that lie to persuade other alleged conspirators to submit false electoral college votes to the Congress, which was going to hold session on January 6th. So his scheme was to defraud the Congress of their rightful duties to certify the vote, because in various states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, Arizona, I think also Pennsylvania and New Mexico, his enterprise, his organization, his conspiracy was trying to get alternate delegates fraudulently submitted to the Congress with the aim of hoodwinking and fooling Congress into thinking that there was a legitimate set of electoral votes. That is a huge attack on democracy. So that trial, if it goes, is probably not going to be conducted until maybe May or June of 2024. And the jury selection process could take 1 or 2 months. That trial may not end until early 2025. But that charge, that RICO charge, is also very serious.
Chris Edelson is an assistant professor in the Department of Government at the American University in Washington.
Talk to us, if you would, about what this means for the rule of law in the U.S. and what kind of test that faces.
I think our system has failed in some important ways here in the United States. In a functioning, healthy liberal democracy, when Donald Trump encouraged and praised the attack on the Capitol on January 6th and was then impeached in the House of Representatives, he would have been removed from office. He was not. And so what we're left with is prosecutions as a way to hold him accountable. The prosecutions you mentioned, and we don't know what will happen, in part because Donald Trump, under the U.S. system, is still allowed to run for president. And I think he sees his best chance of avoiding accountability as being reelected, being elected, not reelected at this point. He's out of office. But I think what he hopes is that he can win election and therefore avoid responsibility in these criminal cases. Donald Trump is a textbook authoritarian. He is somebody who believes the rules do not apply to him. He is a bully at heart, like a Viktor Orban in Hungary, or Modi in India, or Putin in Russia, or a Maduro in Venezuela. It's a global phenomenon. And it's a real test, because authoritarians reject liberal democracy. Authoritarians don't believe in free and fair elections. They don't believe in respecting election results. Will he be able to continue to get away with this? We don't know. And one of the problems, because there was not accountability through the U.S. Senate when he was impeached, one of the problems is it's not guaranteed that the system will hold. We can certainly see a path where Donald Trump will escape accountability. And I think also troubling to me, whether Donald Trump himself escapes accountability or not, the Republican Party has become an authoritarian party in the United States. And I don't see a path forward for U.S. democracy and the rule of law as long as one of the two major parties rejects democracy.
Rachel Payne Caulfield is a professor in the Department of Political Science at Drake University in Iowa.
You know, he has to appear in Manhattan court on January 4. The Iowa caucus is January 15. And yet he's leading in the polls. What does that mean to you?
The indictments appear to, at least at the beginning, be helping Donald Trump. His initial indictment in New York gave him a bounce in the polls. That's less true now as continued indictments come down. But he seems to be served well by the idea that there is an establishment elite that are kind of coming after him. They're politically motivated. They have bad intentions. Donald Trump has always done best when he's fighting against an establishment elite. And so among his supporters, I think that has really solidified support.
In Iowa, at least, we know that the evangelical people are a significant portion of the Republican base. You know, these are Christians who are believe in kind of a moral universe. How are they processing these criminal accusations against the former president?
Well, first of all, I think there's a differentiation that a lot of people make between moral failures and legal failures. And so, you know, evangelicals in 2016 supported Donald Trump, and most people didn't expect that to be the case. Donald Trump is, you know, certainly not your typical evangelical candidate. But I think for many reasons, evangelical voters found his message appealing. And that has tended to remain true. There's a really interesting CBS poll that everyone seems to be talking about right now. And it asks the question, who do you trust to tell you the truth? And respondents, Republican voters and those who lean Republican, 71% of them said that they trusted Donald Trump to tell them the truth. And that is higher than friends and family at 63%. It's higher than, media figures. And in this particular instance, what's really interesting is that only 42% said that they trusted religious leaders to tell them the truth. So Donald Trump is really the animating feature here among Republican voters. They trust him, they like him, and they view him as electable. In fact, you know, up to 80% of them believe that he won in 2020. What we're seeing in the case of Donald Trump, and I think uniquely in the case of Donald Trump, is that he doesn't seem to be affected by continued news of indictments or criminal wrongdoing, allegations, witnesses against him. None of it seems to break through this very, calcified partisan polarization and the very strong support that he has among a segment of the Republican base. He activates that base in a way that no other candidate has been able to. When those mugshots came out of Fulton County, Georgia, it didn't hurt Donald Trump. It helped Donald Trump. He raised money on his mugshot. Anyone who gets Donald Trump emails got emails saying, can you imagine what these people, these corrupt people are doing to me? And he raised millions and millions of dollars on that. So it is astounding in many ways how he can capitalize on this sense of victimhood that he portrays and that a lot of people really identify with.